Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, March 31st. With me now is Nina Khrushcheva, International Affairs Professor at the New School, and she happens to be the great-granddaughter of the Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, who was in office in the 1950s and 60s, remembered for denouncing the crimes of Joseph Stalin and introducing some liberal reforms, but also for the Cuban Missile Crisis. We'll talk about Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine in the context of Russian history and a little bit about Putin in the context of Donald Trump history. Even with Putin committing war crimes in progress, Trump was back at it this week soliciting Putin's help regarding rumors of the Biden family and this and that. Professor Khrushcheva, thank you for coming on at this intense time. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can I ask about Putin in the long sweep of history that includes your great-grandfather? Nikita Khrushchev was known for his campaign of de-Stalinization of Russia, as I don't have to tell you, of course. People are saying Putin is doing re-Stalinization. Can you start historically with Stalin then? Remind people of the things he did that your great-grandfather denounced?
Well, thank you. Putin, I think, goes much further in history than just Stalin or 20th century, because he looks at himself as Putin the Great, and that goes back centuries and centuries and centuries. So Stalin is just one of his predecessors that he admires. He himself never said that he admired Stalin, but the whole system is set up that Putin is the successor of Stalin in a kind of presenting the strong hand, punishing the opponents, bringing up the KGB, FSB, the Federal Security Forces, and during Stalin it was the NKVD forces, then replaced by KGB, into the forefront of the public life, of political life, of social life. And that's exactly what happened. And when we are not at the Stalin level of repressions yet, but the fact that essentially anybody who says anything against the war in Ukraine particularly is being harassed, prosecuted, detained, really brings us back to the memory of the Great Purges, 1937, 1938, when thousands and thousands of people went to prison, went into detention camps, were denounced as enemies of the people. And the fear was just spreading like wildfire, and very similar effects of Putin's repression right now we experience in Russia.
And for the sake of history, and, you know, we have whole generations of listeners who have grown up now with no actual living memory of the Soviet Union, why did Nikita Khrushchev do those denunciations, your great-grandfather, do those denunciations and de-Stalinization, quote-unquote, at that time in the 1950s, rather than just keep quiet about Stalin's crimes and atrocities and take care of current business?
Well, he could have, and it's a very big question, and we don't have an exact answer yet, what could be an exact answer. Khrushchev was... he was a leader in a despotic system, but he himself was not a despot. And I think that kind of differed him from other Stalin's apparatchiks. And Khrushchev, you know, make no mistake about it, he was a very, very determined and very admiring Stalin lieutenant. He, in fact, was the one in 1939, Stalin sent him to Ukraine. He was the first secretary of the Communist Party of Ukraine. By sword and by fire, he was uniting the West Ukraine and East Ukraine in 39. So he was not, you know, collecting stamps and being a lovely butterfly gatherer, obviously. But I think he
collecting
also
stamps. That's funny. Go ahead.
Well, when Stalin died, and Stalin died in 1953, and Khrushchev was the first one among Stalin's lieutenants to start saying we really need to denounce the purges, and we have to explain to the party that we had to do it. It was fear, but it was Stalin's decision. Indeed, others were planning to keep quiet or wanted to keep quiet because Stalin was a great man of history. Khrushchev was pushing for de-Stalinization because, as he himself later on in life said, my arms are covered with blood up to the elbows. And so we felt that we had to really denounce ourselves in front of the party, in front of the people. And that's how he was pushing. He was not an evolutionary reformer in a sense. He wasn't somebody who would be consistent in his reforms in any way, because let's remember that after he denounced Stalin at the 20th Party Congress, February 1956, then in the fall of 1956, Soviet tanks rolled into Hungary to suppress the anti-communist uprisal. So once again, not collecting stamps there. But I think he had humanity, and something that completely is missing today from Putin as a leader. And that's why I think, you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was resolved in 13 days because it became too scary that the humanity really, humanity's existence became at risk in 1962. When Khrushchev was haggling with the John F. Kennedy. I don't think Putin feels this kind of responsibility. I think it's my way or the highway.
I think we have whole generations listening who've never used a stamp either, but that's another show. But I want to ask a question and stay on the deep history before we circle it back to Putin. At least one question, kind of, informed by your book that came out in 2019, In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. And that's 11 time zones now in the post-Soviet era. Why did the Soviet Union form? Why did Ukraine and the Baltic Republics and other areas there become part of a Soviet megastate?
Well, that's, how long is your program? There was a Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. And before the Bolshevik Revolution and the creation of the Soviet Empire, there was a Russian Empire, which held essentially most parts, and then they became republics after the Bolshevik Revolution. They were parts of the Russian Empire, and they sort of transmitted into the Soviet Empire. A lot of them were being fought over. Some pieces went to some republics, some pieces went to other republics. As always, sort of land divisions are complicated. But essentially, the Soviet Union, although people like to break the past from the 20th century present or from the 20th century past now, it really was a continuation of an empire, just a different form of despotic regime, because Russia was before an absolute monarchy, and then it became dictatorship of proletariat. And the minute you have a word dictatorship in anything, that is a dictatorship. Dictatorship is dictatorship no matter what. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we're dealing with history today, and the history of the Russian Empire from time immemorial to today, and the Soviet Union or the Soviet system was just part of those imperial regimes succeeding each other. And for that reason, although of course in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed, a lot of republics, actually most republics, separated themselves from Russia. But the 11 time zones remain, because even today, just imagine that Russia goes on the west side of Russia. It's goes from Germany, the city of Kaliningrad, which used to be East Prussia, all the way to China and all the way to Japan, to the Pacific Ocean. So it continues to be a very, very big country, since you want to stay deep in history or in history. Mm-hmm. When Dmitry Medvedev replaced Putin in 2008 as president, sort of a warming chair, flunky president, he still tried to modernize Russia to some degree. And so he reduced the time zones to 9. So let's not be so dictatorial and so big. Putin came mm-hmm. back in 2012, and 11 time zones that went back into effect again.
Huh. And remind us what happened in Ukraine when the Soviet Union did fall apart 31 years ago, 1991. It wasn't the result of violent insurgencies in Ukraine and elsewhere. Again, for people who didn't live through this history, you know, maybe the one line that people say is, oh, the Soviet Union collapsed and the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. But how did that happen in the case of Ukraine?
Well, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. And what's, by the way, sort of, we talk about Budapest and 56, and there are other instances like Prague in 68 when the Soviet tanks went there as well. In 1989, Mikhail Gorbachev, the last Russian president, Soviet president, Soviet chair of the Communist Party, did not mm-hmm. send tanks. So that was a very dramatic moment in history. It seemed like Russia is finally shedding away its violent oppression of other countries, other republics that do not want to be part of it. In 91, the Soviet Union collapsed peacefully. The agreement was signed by Boris Yeltsin, who was the Russian president at the time, the Republic of Russia president at the time, by the Ukrainian president, the Belarusian president. And so they signed an agreement of this dissociation. And Yeltsin was known at the time to say that to all of the 15 republics and others, saying you can have as much freedom if you can now swallow. And so Ukraine was one of those 15 independent countries that came out as a result of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. But I think Putin's kind of obsession with Ukraine is similar to previous leaders, which Yeltsin was not one of, but with Joseph Stalin, for example, with the Russian Tsars, kind of keeping Ukraine as a Russian appendage rather than an independent nation.
Can I ask how different you see Eastern Ukraine in the context of all that history, consider the more Russian parts and the rest of the country versus the rest of the country in terms of Russian identification or what they want to be nationally? This is in the news even this week as the potential outline for a potential peace agreement where there would be autonomy in the east and Russian's annexation of Crimea in the east would be recognized. How consistent would that be, according to your understanding, with the identification of the people there, and how much would that be a complete imposition of outside rule on a people who want none of it?
Well, and even in the East, we would say, you know, look at the battles of Mariupol. I mean, the Russians have been trying to take it for 36 days now. I mean, I think they right. finally did. But yes. It's a very Eastern city. It used to be a very Russian city. They don't want to be Russians anymore. Odessa was a Russian city, doesn't want to be Russian. Kharkiv was a Russian city, doesn't want to be Russian. So it is, even with the identification of Russians, it's the violence of it and the kind of the matter-of-factness of it that Ukraine belongs to Russia is just appalling for Ukrainians, both Eastern and Western. West Ukraine was also, there's all parts of Poland. For example, my great-grandmother, Nina Khrushcheva, Nikita Khrushchev's wife, she was from West Ukraine. She was from the parts that are now Poland. And she had three native languages. She spoke Polish, her native language, she spoke Ukrainian, her native language, and she spoke Russian. So that is really not part of this is not the mentality or even linguistic abilities that people in the East have. They have Russian and Ukrainian. As I mentioned, Khrushchev was sent by Stalin to unite East and West Ukraine in 39. So even in 39, and even after the war in 46, when he had to oversee the destruction of the Ukrainian Nationalist Party, that these people were the ones who were saying, we would never be Russian. We would never be Soviet. We are fighting against the Soviets. Lviv is one of those cities that never wanted to be Soviet, never wanted to be Russian. And I imagine with increasing kind of Russian rhetoric of domination, the increasing division of the West Ukraine, basically they're saying, we don't even have historical precedent, essentially, to become part of Russia. So leave us alone completely. But I would imagine that even in the East, the desire to be a Russian under Putin is really no longer as appealing as it was, say, even 10 years ago.
We have a few minutes left with Nina Khrushcheva, international affairs professor at the New School, author of the book from 2019, In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. And as she just referred to, she happens to be the great-granddaughter of the Soviet premier from the 1950s and 1960s, Nikita Khrushchev. Let me take one or two phone calls for you before we run out of time. Here's John in Queens Village. John, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Thank you. I'm born in Poland. In Lwów, actually. My father was there, and I am Polish. I consider myself Slavic. But also, the point I want to make is this, and I'm old, okay, so I went through the war also. I'm an old guy. I'm very old. Here's my point. Russia, as it is now, the Bolshevik Soviet Union, as it was, Russia, as it was during the Tsars, has no history. The people really there have no history, no cultural memory of what it is to be free. And I want to point out that that is the same case with China. China has always had emperors and has had dictators. And I think because of that, it is highly unlikely that there will be a serious revolution there. But one hopes. I think a lot of the younger people have left, if they can, in Russia. Of course, we have the disinformation situation. But I'd like to make that comment and see what Ms. Khrushcheva has to add to that. I've read her book, by the way.
Thank you very much. Well, that's quite a pronouncement that the people there have never been free, always lived under autocrats, and therefore will not revolt against Putin.
Well, I agree that people there have rarely been free. There were 5 minutes in the 90s. And then early Putin, although he was already displaying then a strong hand, there were still relative freedoms. But I think what we should absolutely remember that essentially Russia never had free elections. I mean, I think Yeltsin, when he first became president, that was a free moment. But even in 1996, when he was running for his second term, it was already somewhat rigged. For a variety of reasons, and then in 2000, when Putin first became president, he was a successor of Yeltsin. In this sense, I agree. Russia has never been essentially free. Revolutions can happen, but I'm not a fan, like Putin, by the way, just because very rarely, I mean, I think Ukraine is a very rare example when revolutions actually bring some positive results. And I think in 2004, the Orange Revolution, that was a positive result. So Russia is doomed for some time to come because KGB or whatever, FSB now is running the show. And even if the war is over, they're not going to give up the power. And that really saddens me because for years my country is finished.
Then one more related question. I think it's related from Mike in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Is that me?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Dobry utro, gospodzha. My family is from Mogilev, which is right outside of Kiev. My question is really very simple. Khrushchev was a boss one day, and then the generals deposed him. In contrast, Putin has had a decade to solidify his position. Now, while he is close to bankrupting the country, he's bringing in at least 5,000 mercenaries from Syria, and supposedly he is going to conscript at least 100,000 new Russians. Can you predict or foresee any kind of way in which the military establishment could similarly depose Putin. I'll take the answer off the air. Ochen spasibo.
Okay, well, thank you. Actually, Khrushchev was not denounced by the military. It was his political people that took him out. Maybe, I don't know, because Russia actually does not have a history of military coup. They could be KGB coup, FSB coup, the security forces coup, but for them to give up Putin right now would be difficult because that would mean kind of responding to Joe Biden's passionate plea to take him out, which he did, which Joe Biden just did in Warsaw a few days ago. So I would not see that, but I could be very, very wrong. And please, if I am wrong, don't hold it against me.
Since you brought up Biden, one closing question, and just kind of as an addendum to this whole conversation, even with Putin committing the war crimes that he's committing, Donald Trump was back soliciting Putin's help this week regarding rumors of Hunter Biden's finances. Trump said this.
So now I would think Putin would know the answer to that. I think he should release it.
Donald Trump on a program called Just the News. Even Lindsey Graham denounced Trump this week for inviting Putin to help the Republicans politically at this moment in time. What do you make of it with your knowledge of both countries?
Well, I mean, I cannot take Trump seriously ever. I don't understand why we keep discussing him. I mean, yes, he was a former president, but, you know, he was
But the only reason that I bring him up anymore is that he wants to be president again, presumably.
Right. And so my very quick question is that Trump loves attention. And so he's saying things, you know, it's like a survivor's island. He's going to eat cockroaches because everybody else is going to discuss, oh, my God, Donald Trump is eating cockroaches. So I think that could be one of the things. We all talk about Putin. So Trump is jumping in a bandwagon so we can talk about Trump talking about Putin.
Nina Khrushcheva, international affairs professor at the New School, author of the book In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. Thank you very much for all the context.
Thank you very much.
History and analysis you've given us today. Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.